Into Slick Talk. This is your host, Blackstone Joe. Today, I am joined by Ultra 4 Jones, but we're going to use real names, if that's okay with you, Kevin.
Completely fine.
So from now on, don't do the Blackstone Joe thing if you don't want to. I'm not going to instill any rules, but I don't know if you remember maybe the origin story behind that. Like, someone literally just commented on a Facebook post and was like, thank you, Blackstone Joe. And I was like, well, I have no excuse not to run with this now. It has to keep going.
Yeah, that's a pretty good one. I got to admit, I think you got me there.
So one thing that's really cool about this collaboration is it's proof of concept in that when I took over social media, when I wanted to start a podcast, it was exactly for this reason, crossing paths with folks who, you know, either have tested with Blackstone or they haven't. Maybe they heard about it, they want to know more, but then making some connections beyond just report data. So I was really excited when you reached out over Instagram, and here we are today. So that's how I met you. But could you tell the listeners, though, you know, what Ultra 4 is all about? Why would that be in your Instagram username? You know, go over some definitions, I suppose, just to give us a little bit of primer on that.
Yeah, for sure. So I didn't come up with this, but I heard it put this way, and I think they absolutely nailed it. So Ultra 4 is a form of off-road racing, and it's best described if you took a rock crawler and a trophy truck and they made a baby. So you end up with a incredibly capable four-wheel drive vehicle that can travel over pretty much any terrain. So Ultra 4 is a sanctioning body that most notably promotes a race called King of the Hammers every February in California desert. And it's touted as the single hardest one-day race in the world. And I don't really disagree with that, having now raced it a couple of times.
So just talking about difficulty right there, difficulty for the driver as well as the vehicle, a little bit of both. Like what are the challenges when you're handling the wheel that might make it the hardest race?
Yeah, it's really kind of the man versus machine versus the elements. So the terrain out there where the race is held in Johnson Valley, California, it's coveted by the Marines. They actually have a installation right next door, 29 Palms, and they train out there to simulate some of the roughest conditions in the world that our soldiers might fight war in. It's got, you know, vast deserts, but it's also got really tall mountains and very rocky canyons. When you race, they connect all these rocky canyons across the desert, and it ends up being, you know, a multi-hour race. So my first year, we were in the car. It was belted in the car for 9 hours racing. And then this last year, we did it a little bit faster. We did it in about 7 hours.
Wow. So what's going on in there as far as, you know, supplies? Sometimes nature's gonna call. Like, how do you make 9 hours happen? Because like, I don't have a lot of great comparisons on my end, but when I did a marathon, it was a lot to even consider 4 hours of constant physical strain and just being like, all right, how much am I gonna bring with me? How am I gonna manage the survival process?
Yeah, for sure. So you know, you hit one of the points or questions that most people ask is, well, how do you go to the bathroom? And there's a device called a racing catheter. It installs more like a contraceptive device, but then it's got a tube that you run out the bottom of your race suit. So we've got number ones covered while racing, but number twos are, you just got to plan your, you know, your calories and meals accordingly to hopefully time that right. But yeah, I keep a Camelback in the car, so I easily go through probably 100 ounces of water in that time. Wearing the, you know, the double layered Nomex race suit, it's very hot regardless of the weather outside. The car is making a lot of heat. You're constantly trying to stay hydrated to avoid, you know, muscle cramps and fatigue and mental exhaustion. I don't eat much. I try to have a, you know, a good dinner before and a very light breakfast, but yeah, a lot of hydration along the way for sure.
So when you're getting into the build though, I mean, was this just hours and hours of YouTube research combined with phone calls and emails with people who have been there before? Like, cause you know, when you're going into this event, how big a deal it is. So you want to get the build right, at least as right as you can the first time. So just going into the preparation, how did you go about getting that build as close to, you know, greatness as you could first time out?
Yeah, no, that's a good one. I got exposed to this through a mutual friend of a racer, and he said, "Hey man, we're going out to this desert thing. It's really cool. There's this big automotive component to it. You got to be really mechanically savvy. You'd probably really enjoy this. You should come with us." So I went with him and kind of helped this guy that I was meeting for the first time race. And I just thought, man, I could do this. I could totally do this. It's right up my alley. And I decided to help him for, I think, 4 or 5 years before I finally took the plunge myself, and learned a lot just helping, being kind of a pit crew member. But I also learned that I really didn't know what I wanted in a quote race car. So I decided to buy a used car and start with that so that I could get my feet wet and kind of decide what things I liked and didn't like. So I ended up finding a used car for sale that had raced King of the Hammers multiple times, but had never actually had any success and never finished the race. So that's what I started with.
And just to give the listeners a little more context here, I mean, what do these typically look like? I mean, you mentioned, you know, it's going to have some elements of a rock crawler for sure. But do certain cars start out their lives as something else and then they're morphed into an Ultra 4? Or what do they look like at the beginning of their lives, if not an Ultra 4 racer?
Yeah, so there's multiple classes within the race. So you've got, at the bottom, you've got stock class. So those vehicles do start as a stock vehicle, and the rules dictate that they have to maintain a lot of factory sheet metal. They have to utilize original suspension type and design. You have to run an engine that came in the vehicle, things like that. So a lot of people end up running, you know, as you can imagine, like a Jeep Wrangler or a Toyota pickup truck, and then modifying it basically, you know, as far as the rules will allow them to. And then above that, you've got what they call modified, where you can cleverly disguise a essentially custom built tube chassis vehicle as a Jeep, you know, if you put a grill and a hood on it. And then that class has some specific rules as well. And then you've got my class, which is called Legends or 4800. And it was originally intended as a class where the original Unlimiteds could kind of retire. But as with any racing, as soon as you create a rule book, people find loopholes in it. So there's now, you know, a lot of very custom built high-end cars running in a quote Legends class. Which is fine. It's good. It's fun. It's a very competitive class. So my car started as just a bunch of straight tube on, you know, on the rack at your local steel supplier, and was just slowly turned into a tube shaped chassis and filled with an engine and transmission and axles, and not a lot of vehicle specific parts on my car.
So now, I mean, of course, we have to get into a little bit of our lane, which is the oil. Is it just like anywhere else where people are each going to swear by their own favorite thing, or is there a superior brand blend that people say you have to be using this? What's the oil talk like, if any, in that community?
Yeah, it is just like any other form of racing that I've been around in my life, where you've got the diehards that swear by, you know, this is what my dad always used, this is what I use. Then you've got the guys that are like, "Hey, I don't care what I use. If a sponsor, a brand is willing to give it to me, I'll use it." And then you've got a lot of guys that, you know, "Well, so and so does good, and he uses this, so I'll use this." And I'm probably more just my own man of, you know, I know I've worked on a lot of things automotive in my life, and I kind of, I don't know, have had anything I've had good luck with is something I tend to fall back on. So.
And what are the, I mean, as far as, you know, weights go, is there a typical weight you'll see everyone using? Does that vary just so much depending on the car? What do you run in particular?
Yeah, it does vary. I think you get a lot of guys that don't really understand oil technology, viscosity ratings even, and they buy something because it sounds cool or the numbers are bigger or something like that. But for me, my engine is out of a 2005 Escalade. It's a 6-liter Chevy LS engine, and it's not modified in the oiling system other than an aftermarket pan. So I run Mobile One off the shelf from, my local Walmart. I don't run a heavy viscosity. I run a 1040. And then in the transmission, I just run the local auto parts brand Type F transfluid, because that's what my transmission builder wanted me to run. It's a Chevy Turbo 350. And then in my differentials, I run actually a 250 weight oil made by Maxima, because the guy that sets up my ring and pinion gears for me, that's what he asked me to run, that he's had good luck with. And then in the transfer case, I run a Redline brand heavy shockproof oil, because the company that makes the transfer case asked that you run that oil. So, a lot of the times, if I don't know, I'll just go with a manufacturer recommendation. Or like in the case of the differentials, this guy is putting his name on the product, the labor that he does for me. And, I want to be respectful of what he's asking me to do. So, I run the oil that he recommends.
Yeah. A couple interesting things there. One of them being shockproof. So that's a unique product in that when we see it in testing, it has so much additive present. I don't have the numbers in front of me right now, but if I remember right, it has just an absurd amount of calcium compared to, similar products. And what ends up happening with all that additive when we get in testing is it will fall out of suspension to the point where when we're measuring solids, how many insolubles are present, you'll just see all this additive collecting that fell out during test. It's not because it's a problem with the oil. It's how it behaves when it's being tested. And it's just white solid, purely additive, and it's not a problem. But I remember when I first looked at a sample and I was getting ready to, talk about it with the customer, I was like, oh my gosh, so much oxidation. This oil broke down tremendously. It was in terrible shape. And then, we learn, obviously, we ask each other questions, more seasoned analysts who have been around the block. And one of them, I asked them, I was like, look at this oil, something's so wrong. And they're like, no, it's just shockproof, as additive, a lot of it. And then when we test it, that's just how it behaves. But yeah, it's a unique product for that reason.
Well, that's pretty interesting. So the properties of the calcium help absorb some of the shock load? Is that kind of the intent there?
It's definitely a boosted additive package compared to what you typically see. And I think it's obviously meant to somehow counter, the extreme use that it's going to be experiencing. Now, it's always hard to nail down exactly the benefits of these additives when people are changing oils all the time, or if they, don't build a trend line. But you'll see the additive itself kind of separate out. Only though in cases where it's just so heavily present. But yeah, you mentioned Mobile One too, and that's a product that, I don't mind running at all either. One thing that really I value about our testing is spotting things like a coolant leak really early. And Mobile One, I know, doesn't use any significant sodium. Sodium's a coolant marker. So I can go, okay, if I'm running Mobile One, I know for sure I can catch a coolant leak without any ambiguity. It's not like I've been dumping Valvoline or Royal Purple, and then I have to wonder, oh, is some of that sodium antifreeze or is it purely oil additive? So
right.
It's not to badmouth those other brands, but I like having that, no doubt about it, a source of elements like that.
Yeah, for sure. That makes a ton of sense.
So Ultra 4 is a good jumping off point, but you have just so much experience beyond that. And one area I wanted to go to, you mentioned you've built, I think, over a dozen engines. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, you quit. You're super excited about the first couple, and then after that, you kind of lose track a little bit. But
so what was your learning, your very first learning experience? I guess maybe a way to look at it is the first one where you kind of had to be accountable for it. Like there was no answer but you doing the build, because I know that that's got to be a different experience mentally than when you have like help around you.
Sure. Yeah. No. So I think I was probably 18 and I bought a 68 Ford Galaxy for $100. And the guy told me it has a bad lifter and it started and ran and it just had this very loud tick, you know, and it was a 390 FE engine for anybody that's familiar with that family. It's basically kind of like a redheaded stepchild of the 428 or even the 427 that most people are familiar with in the Cobras and stuff. But I took it to a you know, more educated friend and I was like, yeah, I got this great car. You know, I said, it's just got a bad lifter. You know, I looked those up. They're really cheap, you know, and he just laughed at me. And I said, well, what, you know, and he said, that's not a bad lifter. He's like, it probably doesn't have any oil pressure. So we pulled the sending unit out and put a mechanical gauge in. And sure enough, the car only had, you know, 10 pounds of oil pressure. So pretty soon after that, I took the engine out in my parents' driveway and took it all apart and took it down to a local machine shop. And the guy was kind enough to take me under his wing a little bit and told him I didn't have much money to work with, but you know, this thing didn't have any oil pressure. And he taught me a lot. That guy ended up helping me with several engine builds probably over the next 10 years of my life or so.
And was there one as far as where it was only you, you know, handling it from top to bottom?
Yeah. I mean, that was honestly the one where I'd help my dad, I think, take an engine out or put it in or something in a car he had, or maybe for my brother or something, but I didn't really care, you know, it wasn't my car. But that was the first one that I took the engine out. I took it all apart and the machinist, you know, did what he needed to do. And then I took all the pieces home and used the, you know, some old crusty manual that I don't even remember where we got, you know, this is kind of before just Googling anything you wanted to know, and just used all the torque specs and put the thing all back together, starting from a bare block and put it in the car. And I remember starting it up and breaking in the cam at probably 11 o'clock at night, you know, and for those that aren't familiar, when you break in an engine with a flat tappet hydraulic camshaft, you have to run it at elevated RPM for about 20 minutes to break in the wear surface on the bottom of the lifters or the top of the cam lobes. And I remember some of my neighbors coming over in like their, you know, robe and slippers and yelling at me, telling me, don't you know what time of night it is? And how can you're making all this racket? And, you know, as an 18-year-old kid, all you're thinking about is just putting your car back together.
Oh yeah. I mean, break-in waits for no man. So that had to be exciting too, right? I mean, you finally reached the point where you're ready to break the thing in. Like, you know, that had to be exciting.
Yeah. I vividly remember, you know, we got it. I took this thing apart because it had no oil pressure. And then we started it up and instantly raised the idle to like 2,500 RPM. And the oil pressure exceeded 100 PSI. And I quickly shut it off and made a phone call to a family friend that knew more than I did. He's like, well, what's wrong? You know? And I said, it has too much oil pressure now. And you know, he kind of laughed and he's like, well, how much do you have? And I said, it's making like 100 pounds. And he said, it'll go down. It'll be all right. He's all, and if it doesn't, it'll just blow the oil filter off, you know? And sure enough, by the end of the 20 minute break in, it was fine. But all these things that you don't know about and you're kind of learning seat of your pants.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, and you're sitting there like all that work put in and then, you know, it's the most stressful 20 minutes, you know, to wait and see what happens.
Oh, yeah.
But other builds, though, I'm curious, like, is there one in particular you remember where when you got it done, you kind of thought never again, or where there was just maybe more frustration? Like, did you learn, you know, one type of build and think you had it whipped, and then one came along that just asked more of you than you thought? Like, how do you view some of these past experiences?
You know, I've honestly enjoyed most of them. Yeah, anytime you dive that deep and you touch that many details, you will have problems. I remember we overthought how to build this 2.3 liter inline four cylinder for a Ford Ranger, and we tried to just totally geek out on it. We're going to run a Mustang camshaft and you know, the cylinder head off of this, and I don't even remember all the little things we did. And we thought we were just going to build the hottest little 2.3 four cylinder, and that Ranger ran horribly. It made less horsepower than a stock Ford Ranger, and it was just such a bummer. And but it really taught me that, you know, these things are they're a recipe, and you can't just throw random ingredients at them. You really have to get the process right, and you have to do your homework. But there's that one. And then I put together a 3.4 liter for a Toyota, I think they call that a 5VZFE or something like that, 3.4 liter Toyota engine. And it went together really good, but I didn't install the camshafts themselves. And the timing belt drives one camshaft, and then, and I can't remember if it's the intake or the exhaust, but then there's a gear off of that cam that drives the opposite camshaft per head. So the machine shop put the cylinder heads back together, and I just put the whole thing together and went about my day. And I finally get it running, and it fires up, and it only runs on three cylinders. And man, I just chasing my tail. I was checking everything and ignition circuits, and okay, this whole side of the engine's dead. You know, it's got to be bad coils or something in the wiring harness, or you know, and this was a truck that I bought not running, so I really had no history with it. You know, got to the point where I said, okay, let's just go back down to basics. Let's go fuel, air, compression, spark. And I got to compression, and it had none on that side. And I thought, well, that's really odd for a brand new engine. So dug a little deeper, and come to find out that the two camshafts had been phased wrong. They'd been installed basically 180 degrees out from where they should have been. So, you know, I spent the better part of a day blaming myself, and then come to find out it was just a simple mistake that the machine shop made, and you know, they didn't know it, and obviously they didn't mean to. So,
well, that's incredibly gracious of you to have that outlook, because I can't tell you, I mean, you know, it's not quite on the same note, but so many samples come our way from folks that either want to like pin the blame on a shop for a problem with the engine, or they want to, you know, find a flaw with the dealership as far as, you know, the oil change they did. That sort of angst definitely powers a lot of our samples that we see come in.
Yeah, I mean, you have to understand, and you know, maybe some more of my background that we'll get into kind of explains it, but we've all made mistakes. We're all human. So, you know, on the other end of your anger is another human that probably just made an honest mistake. You know, I've done it. I can't have too much anger towards somebody else that's done it.
And a lot of this empathy probably comes from your time as an ASE tech, right? As far as learning how to navigate these, you know, these problems that you had to solve. So just go through that time. What was, you know, as far as being a tech, how did that come into play?
Sure. Yeah. So I kind of touched on that, you know, that Galaxy, but I was looking for something in high school. I had kind of a mechanical drive for sure, working on, you know, my dirt bikes and stuff as a young teenager. And I took an automotive class in my high school, and I was approached by the teacher one day. He said, hey, I know the owner of this shop, and he's looking for a guy that would, you know, maybe come down after school and sweep the floors and maybe do some oil changes and stuff. Would you be interested? I hadn't really thought about it, you know, up until then. I thought I was just, you know, learning at school. So I went down there, and yeah, next thing you know, I'm every day after school, I'm working from, you know, 2 to 6 doing oil changes and cleaning up the shop. And then oil changes turn into brake jobs, and brake jobs turn into, you know, timing belts, and timing belts turn into, you know, everything else. And the owner and his wife, you know, they said, we'd be willing to pay you more if you went and got some ASE certifications, Automotive Service of Excellence, which is kind of the kind of bar by which, you know, mechanics are rated. So I said, well, sure. How does that work? They told me for every certification I got, they'd pay me like a quarter more an hour. So quickly got online and figured out where I could go get these certifications and take these tests, and just started studying and taking every test I could. And I started taking classes at local junior college at night. And I just really loved it. I soaked it all up. I mean, I was a teenager. I enjoyed mechanical things. I was an absolute sponge. So I took every class I could, and I took every test I could. I was really headed down that path pretty seriously for a couple of years there.
When it came to oil changes, I'm curious, was there any conventional wisdom, any kind of across the board, this is how long engines should go, period, or were they very detailed recommendations back then, depending on what engine you were talking about, what oil you were talking about? I'm just curious because I remember talking to a guy who worked at an oil change place, you know, around the time I started at Blackstone, and he just asked me like what I was pretty sure was a trick question. He was like, when do you need to change the oil, or like, how long can you run the oil? And I was like, that's not a simple answer. Yeah. That has many, many facets. So anyway,
yeah.
How were those recommendations given out in your time?
So we're going back 20 years, and I would say that was, you know, there was probably technology like what Blackstone offers, but I don't think it was as readily available, readily known. And at the time, that was just the, you know, 3 months, 3,000 miles type of thing. And really all we did was we were a certified Napa Auto Care Center. And so we had the biggest profit margin on Napa brand oil. So unless a customer specifically requested, you know, oh, I have this fancy car and, you know, it needs something special, or, you know, we pretty much just put the Napa brand oil in it, which I was told at the time was purchased and rebranded from Valvoline, but I never saw any lineage of that I could verify. And then the weight was honestly just based on mileage. You know, I think kind of the earliest explanation I ever got, and, you know, something this simple probably makes you cringe in your line of work, but oil pressure is essentially a measure of resistance to flow. So the oil pressure in your engine is really a measurement of the oil escaping through the tolerances of your engine. So if your tolerances are really tight in a newer, fresher engine, then you're going to see more oil pressure because the oil's having a hard time squeezing out of those main bearing clearances, rod bearing clearances, cam journals. And so if you had a newer car or lower miles and you had what we perceived as probably good oil pressure, you probably received a lighter viscosity oil. But maybe if you had a higher mileage or older vehicle that maybe didn't have the manufacturing tolerances that we did, you know, at that time new, then maybe you got more of like a 2050. And then you could always factor in like seasons. And keep in mind, I live and grew up on this, you know, the coast of California. So it's not like we even have seasons like you do, but you know, you might run something a little lighter in the winter and something a little heavier in the summer. But that was really our kind of crude approach to oil changes.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, obviously all of that makes sense to me. You know, I've heard that so many times. Folks still want to carry that over to the now, though, which is interesting. And sometimes there are consequences to it. You know, when people see a 0-16 requirement nowadays, and they're terrified, so they'll naturally want to run something, you know, something thicker. And then what can also happen, though, you know, and this happened back in the day, as I'm sure it happened now, but people will either doubt that manufacturing has made any advancements, or they'll want to outsmart the manufacturer. It's like you see equal amounts of both. And I'm curious, how often do you come across folks who just don't believe whatever the manual calls for, wanna outsmart the manual, so on and so forth? Do you come across that a lot, like an Ultra 4 or outside of that?
I mean, I guess there's two questions there. One is, what do I see now in the racing community? And you know, two, what did I see then? And I feel like back then, I would say most consumers, and they're not the listeners of your podcast, right? Because the demographic that listens to this is, you know, essentially like the one percenters of people that can't get enough of this stuff. So most of the demographic that rolls into an automotive repair center, they just don't even know. They don't want to know. They just want their car to work. So I would say most people never even questioned, doubted anything. But as soon as you start to get into niche cars, and I've heard you talk about this on your podcast, where, you know, you've got a large like BMW market, got a large diesel truck, you know, market, where now you're starting to get into these niche vehicles where people just seem to be a little bit more in tune with their vehicle, hypersensitive, you know, whatever you want to call it. And every time you touch into something like that, you know, you're always going to get people that are want to make sure that you're, you know, you're using Mobil 1 in my Corvette, right? It says on the oil fill cap, only use Mobile One. And it's like, yeah, we'll put whatever you want in your Corvette. We're going to charge you for it. It's really your call. It doesn't matter. So that was kind of the automotive repair side. But the racing community side is people are always, they're almost like superstitious where they're, you know, they're trying to look for some secret edge or, you know, figure out something that somebody else hasn't figured out, you know, the little, you know, next thing or, you know, leg up on the competition. And I honestly think people overthink it. Like I said, I go to Walmart and I buy Mobile One and I put it in my engine. Now that engine I'm going to be pulling out here shortly and we're going to be tearing it completely apart. And I'm very excited to see, you know, what the inside of that thing looks like, because I know what maintenance I've done to it since I've owned it. And then I also know what, you know, life it's been put through, which hasn't been very kind. So.
Yeah, I think you touched on basically, you know, I could never in blunt terms tell folks, hey, you're overthinking it, but sometimes I want to. I think you would probably agree with this, but correct me if I'm wrong. You know, no matter what you buy, oil-wise, additive-wise, I think you would agree that if an engine or a transmission has a problem, you know, be it contamination or, you know, it's making a horrendous noise, it literally, you know, has no oil pressure and you know it's not a problem with a sending unit, whatever. Doesn't matter what you buy, you know, the oil's not going to make that go away.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, what are some of the old terms? Snake oil, mechanic in a bottle. When you have a true hard mechanical problem, it's hard to fix metal problems with liquid solutions. I just don't know that really exists. And a lot of my opinions are based on not just being an automotive technician back then or being, you know, running a race car now, but it's several decades of driving and owning what I would call junk cars. And the things I've done to my junk cars that they have tolerated and, you know, basically it's always funny to me. You always, people like to say like, oh, this car was mechanic owned. And that always makes me laugh inside, because by the time a mechanic gets off duty, he's so burned out on working on your car. He doesn't want to work on his own cars. So all the mechanics I work with drove really junky cars. And I've honestly carried that through till today. My daily driver is a 1997 Geo Prism that's going to hit 300,000 miles this month. And I'm not that picky about what oil I put in it. In fact, I usually just open my cabinet and whatever I have an extra quart of is what I put in it. So, you know, I feel like I've had a lot of life examples that have taught me any oil is more important than no oil, or, you know, something to that effect. Where now I'm not telling you if you have a high tolerance machine and it's incredibly, you know, detail built that you shouldn't use the right lubricants and you shouldn't put the right things in it. But I think people overthink it a lot and they fail to understand that these things are so well engineered, they will tolerate an incredible amount of abuse.
That so much of that rang so true. And especially when you're talking about, so of course it applies, you know, to mechanics, you know, who don't have time to make repairs, because the reason that stuck out to me, everyone I know who's like a contractor or a subcontractor, you know, like not just a handyman, like it's literally their job to build houses or, you know, do electric work, plumbing, whatever. Their houses always have 3 to 5 or more things wrong that just will never get fixed. Like there's a door hanging off the hinge or there's this or the other. And yeah, it makes so much sense. And I think, and it's not to tell folks, hey, you know, don't worry about oil. That's not the story here at all. So much as use the oil, as far as in my line of work, you want to use the oil to find problems. You don't use oil to mask problems. There's a very big divide there.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I don't even know if we've had a lot of conversations over the last several months, you and I, but one of the samples I sent in was actually a additive that I was being asked as a racer to run. Hey, would you use this product? Would you promote it? And I said, I can't promote something that I have no information on. And it had a very catchy sales pitch and it used a lot of fancy words. And I said, I'm going to need more out of this. What can you give me? And there was a lot of fluff that went with this kind of sales pitch. And I finally just sent a sample to Blackstone, and I don't have the the full summary in front of me, but the very first line stuck out to me, and it said, "This sample appears to be mostly motor oil." And I that's been my lifetime experience with people looking for miracles in a bottle, and I think there's a lot of companies out there that are preying on people's hopes and dreams.
Well, yeah. And the way I view it a lot of the time is, think about the years, the money, the research, the time that's been devoted, not just to the machines themselves, but then also the oil. And do you really think that over all this time, all the great big oil companies have just missed the secret formula that the additives have? But yeah, that's just been my perspective. But there's one other area that we haven't touched on, but I think I want to save this if you're open to it, because we've covered a lot today, but there's one other topic that I think could just eat up a whole episode, and I'd be excited to make it one. You sent in samples to Blackstone, and your own engine samples. What all have you sampled other than the additive? I know you sent in one or two engine samples. What all have you sent our way?
Yeah, honestly, you just surmised it right there. So the backstory to our connection here is I'm very active on my social media for my racing. And a lot of the times on my Instagram stories, I'll just kind of show what I'm doing, what I'm working on. And sometimes I'll ask questions just to the followers. And one of my followers, Frank, he's Mud Raider on Instagram out of Florida, I think. He instantly commented on something I asked about oil. He said, "Oh, you should check out Blackstone or listen to Slick Talk." And I don't remember exactly what he said. And I said, "Oh, I think I've heard of Blackstone because I also own a 7.3 power stroke diesel." And I remember in all my years of research on that truck that you certainly come across in the forums, people doing oil sampling. But he said, "Yeah, you should check them out. And they have a podcast." And I thought, how does a oil laboratory have a podcast? So I owe it to Frank for turning me on to this. But I've listened to every episode, and I've learned a lot. But I all I've had time to do in the last few months of being a follower and a listener and a fan is I sent in two samples for my race car, and then I sent in that sample of the additive just to see if there was some magic potion in there. But no, my plans for the future are, as the race program develops, certainly send the engine oil samples in more regularly. And then also, my 7.3 is getting up there in mileage. It's up at about 347, I think, right now. I'd like to learn a little bit more about that as that truck ages. I don't know. I just, I enjoy a good education, and your oil analysis reports have definitely shed some light on some things that I never considered. One of the reasons I thought about doing it for the race car would be important is I don't have a super sophisticated program. I don't have a ton of money to go racing. So unlike some of my competitors that might take their engine out and tear it apart and analyze it for damage, I don't have the time or money to do that. So what I'm hoping to gain out of oil analysis is if I can get a baseline, I can start getting trends and we can track metal, that maybe I could save myself, a DNF in a race or because of, an engine coming apart, or if we spot the sodium potassium of a potential head gasket. So I'm really hoping to use it as a diagnostic tool for helping me decide when I need to, take the engine out of the race car and take it apart.
That all sounds good to me. And I would be excited to bring in some of these report findings if you're cool with it. And what we can do is really kind of do a live on-air analysis and just look at the numbers, see what you've got. We can include even, the numbers, sans client info, contact info, obviously all that. Just get the numbers.
Sure.
And then include them in the show notes and people can check them out. That would be fun. I'd love to go back into that. Because again, we could go for hours and hours on that.
Oh yeah.
And I would love to touch base again on that.
Yeah, let's do it.
So this has been a lot of fun. I've learned a lot. I knew I would, because I mean, all of our customers, you can imagine, like, you know, the varied usage of the engines, the transmissions, it's all across the board. So getting the chance to pick your brain on, you know, what you're up to, what you're asking of your engines, of your oil. I mean, it's exciting stuff. So I'm glad to have you on. Everyone who is not familiar yet, get familiar with Ultra 4 Jones on Instagram. That's his Instagram handle. Like he mentioned, updates his stories all the time, so you can see what's going on in the garage. I love checking him out. So if you haven't yet, give him a follow.
Right on. Thanks, Joe.
All right. Yeah. Thanks for joining me, Kevin. Until next time, this is Blackstone Joe signing off.